This is the book Countryside and Cloister, Reminiscences of a Carmelite Nun by Marie T. Litchfield. Chapter 1, Beginnings Beside the Thames. One of my earliest memories is of looking up at the flowers of sorrel in a hayfield. I must have been very small, probably 3 years old, because the flowers were a lot taller than I, and seemed to make a forest around me. But the tiny bright scarlet drops hung down and trembled in the sunshine. We moved from that area shortly afterwards, and it was a long time before I met sorrel again and discovered its name. By then I was much taller than the plant and saw it from above. Yet it had, and still has, a mysterious beauty for me. At each stage of my life, the growing things around me have left their own particular mark and fragrance on the event. At the time, I've often not been aware of it. Yet, looking back later, the memory has come of some plant or tree, or maybe a bird song, that was part of what happened, so that the sight of that particular plant or the sound of that bird song will automatically bring to mind the essence of the event. This is probably everyone's experience, but I had never noticed it until recently. My parents lived in London after their marriage. They rented a large room, in which, to their joy, there was a piano. It was perfectly adequate for their needs for the first 2 or 3 years, but when the second baby was on the way, they tried to get somewhere with a little more space. A friend, Lucy, who became a lifelong auntie to the family, suggested they took rooms in her parents' house in the village of Horton, near Windsor. It was a large old country house called Home Close, and we rented 2 rooms, a large pleasant living room and a smaller bedroom leading from it. There was no tap or sink or cooker of any kind. The house had a bathroom from which Mother filled a jug of fresh water every day, and we managed with that. A screen across one corner of the room kept the few cooking utensils, washing up, and pails of soaking baby washing from being too obtrusive. A small oil stove, which sometimes smoked and blackened everything, was the only cooking facility. But Mother was young, and it was all part of the adventure of having a little home of her own. In those days, 1931, this was quite a normal setup, and she managed very well. She had never learnt to cook, although, probably because, her mother had been an expert in the field. Many were the tales she used to tell in later years of the things they had to bury, or otherwise dispose of, particularly her first attempts at pastry and jam making. The latter simply resisted all attempts to remove it from the jar, and had to be thrown away in the end, jar and all. Horton was a quiet village on the Thames, low-lying and often misty, but with some beautiful riverside walks. Milton had lived there for part of his life, and wrote some of his loveliest works during that time. The house had a large garden and orchard. The old couple did not object to children enjoying themselves, so by the time I was able to run about, there was somewhere safe to play. When I was nearly 2, my sister Boo was born. Her real name was Antoinette, but very early on she acquired the nickname Boo, and it has stayed with her to this day. Most of my recollections of those early years are of the 2 of us playing in the orchard, and on a swing made with a piece of rope that Mother had tied onto a branch for us near the house. Sometimes she would sit and read to us on a mossy log on sunny afternoons. I have liked mossy logs ever since. There were nightingales there, which I am told sang in the tree just outside the windows, but I was too young to appreciate their song, or perhaps I was asleep and didn't hear it. In the summertime, when we were playing in the orchard, we would sometimes hear the jingle of bells in the distance, growing gradually closer. We would race back to the house as fast as our legs could carry us, indoors and upstairs, shouting breathlessly, "Ferrari! Ferrari!" There would be a hasty consultation between my parents, as they searched for a few coppers. There was always a lack of money in our house. We could try to get Father to come out with us, while we jumped up and down in sheer agony, lest it would be too late, and the jingling little cart would have passed by. It seemed to take grown-ups so long to get down the stairs, along the driveway, and on into the road. Oh, bless, there it was, the little white horse-drawn ice-cream cart, with bells all along the sides of its canopy, and Ferrari himself, a genial Italian, short, middle-aged, with a moustache, leaning over the side to see what we wanted. My parents always tried to buy something from anyone who came round the houses selling things. They knew from experience what it was to be hard up, and if they only had a few pence in the world, they would still buy some little thing. Father loved Italians and anything Italian, so he and Ferrari would have a chat, probably in Italian. We two children would stand by, admiring the horse and licking our ice creams. Then off Ferrari would drive, and the bells jingled and tinkled away into the distance. Outings were rare, and in a sense unnecessary, as we had the run of a good part of the garden. When I look back, I think Mother must have found it rather confining. Mothers were very much tied to the home and children in those days. Ordinary people did not have cars, and money was so scarce. Once in a while, however, we did go out as a family to Windsor, which was fairly near. This was a great thrill. Windsor Castle, the guards outside it, the river with its pleasure boats, the shops and busy streets. All this appealed to Mother. While I lived in London, there had been plenty for her to see and do on foot. Even after I was born, she would still get around with me in the pram and visit museums and places of interest. She loved markets, even if she had nothing to spend, and there was always lots of people to watch. At Horton, life must have been very quiet. However, we two little girls kept her quite busy, and she was always a great reader. Though there was no piano in this flat, the elderly couple who owned the house had one in a rarely used lounge, and they let Mother play it. She even had a couple of pupils, girls from the village. She had taught piano and music theory before her marriage. She had left school at 14 and begun work in a clothing factory. Music had been her great passion since she was a little girl. Her family was very musical, and she had had regular music lessons. One of her piano teachers had also given her singing lessons, for she had a true and sweet voice. After leaving school, she continued her music lessons and also went to night school, studying English and elocution. At 17, after passing the necessary exams, she became a music teacher with a brass plate on the gate of their home. She was very proud of that. The photograph of this lovely young girl wearing her cap and gown always adorned the sitting room of our home. Apart from short gaps when there was no piano, she continued to teach music for an hour or so every day for the rest of her life. Even until she died at the age of 80, she was still giving occasional lessons to her young grandchildren. She had a great gift with children. We used to say that she could teach anyone to play. She knew just how to enter into their world and talk to them in their own language, and pass on to them some of her own enthusiasm and love for the piano. Sometimes her pupils were adults, but the vast majority were children. Often they were from families with very small incomes, but as she charged so little for her lessons, they were able to benefit from her great musical gifts. She could have charged a lot more. It would have helped our own economic situation greatly. But neither she nor my father would have been happy to do so. It would have meant that only the better-off pupils could afford to learn. They loved to think of all those children, the have-nots as they might be called today, being able to enter into the great world of music and enjoy making their own. Some of her pupils actually went on to make a career in music, but for most of them it was a new dimension to an otherwise fairly restricted life. We stayed at Horton until I was 6 and Boo 4, and by then another baby was on the way. Plans began to be talked over, photographs of houses looked at, and a lot of heart searching done. We two children had already begun to put down roots, and entered with energy into the discussions, saying that if we went to live in another house, there would have to be an orchard. We had grown to love playing among the trees, and couldn't imagine life without them. Perhaps our demands did carry some weight. Before leaving the area, my father took us to London, knowing that we were not likely to be going there again for a long time. It was one of his sudden ideas, but perhaps rather extravagant. Though she went along with it, I felt even at the time that Mother didn't really think it was a sensible thing to do, because money was so scarce. We went to Bertram's Mill Circus, which at that time was very grand. We spent the night at a hotel, planning a visit to Madame Tussaud's the following day. It was all very wonderful, and almost the best part was unpremeditated, for as we came out of the hotel in the morning, there on the pavement, surrounded by children, was a Punch and Judy show. We had never seen anything like it, and were thrilled, which gave an added joy to our parents. The whole outing and the visit to Madame Tussaud proved to be such a great success that we remembered and talked of it long afterwards. Even Mother liked to look back on the event, despite her anxiety at the time. She was probably feeling the discomfort of pregnancy too. And so we left Horton, the occasional visits to Windsor, and the walks by the pleasure boats on the Thames, and we headed for Somerset. Chapter 2. To the West Country. It was on a wintry January day that we saw the village of Ashgod for the first time. In years gone by, but at that time still remembered there, Ashgod had held its annual fair on that day, January the 9th, and the local pubs had stayed open all day. By 1936, the two main fairs of the area were at Glastonbury, 5 miles away, and Bridgewater, some 10 miles in the other direction. Bridgewater Fair was very old, and mentioned in the Domesday Book. The fairs still go on every year, and people from miles around buy and sell, or just enjoy the fun there. Cattle and goods have been sold in the streets at Ashgod Fair too, and a local man, whom we knew well in later years, had played his fiddle on the village green, while the young folk danced to his music. We had travelled by train to Glastonbury. At that time, almost every small town, and even village, had its railway station. My father had gone in the removal van, with our few pieces of furniture, and Mother had the task of bringing the two little girls in the train. Not easy, because we were a lively pair, and the journey took several hours. In years to come, we were to get to know Glastonbury well, but at that time it seemed like a big, strange place. My father met us at the station and took us to a small hotel where we were to spend our first night in Somerset. There was a life-size cardboard figure of a monk pointing the way upstairs, which caught our imagination. The next morning we all set off by bus for Ashgod, the village which was to become part of our lives, indeed part of ourselves for the rest of our lives. On that January morning, grey and cold, it must have looked rather bleak, but we children were excited at the thought of seeing our new home, and prepared to be critical of it. If it didn't measure up to our hopes and expectations, there was going to be trouble. At 6 and 4 we were able to give our views in no uncertain terms. For our parents, all must have been quite different. This was their first home of their own, after having lived in rented rooms since their marriage. Though it was not yet paid for, it meant privacy, peace, and freedom. Rooms had been satisfactory in that we had somewhere to live, with places for children to play both indoors and out. It was the large garden which we had found difficult to leave, and which gave us a standard of comparison as we came to examine our new abode. As we walked together up the road, which was only a small country lane then, we saw our house. Some 200 years before, the wise builders had designed it so that the early morning sunshine shone cheeringly into the kitchen at the back of the house, where the housewife would spend much of the first part of the day, while the living room and bedrooms at the front had the benefit of its fuller warmth later on. Built of light grey ham stone, with a red pantile roof, it stood close to the lane, with a garden at the side and the little orchard beyond. Many of the houses around had these little orchards, growing mainly cider apples, for this was cider country. January daylight hours are short, so it was a blow to find that the electric lights, which we had expected to find in some of the rooms, were not working. Father set out to try to find someone who knew about electricity in the village. One of the neighbours kindly told him that he thought Mr. Dibble knew something about mending fuses. Fortunately, this man was at home and came along to look at the lights. He was able to make them work, and we were deeply relieved to be able to see our way around the unfamiliar place, where boxes had been dumped haphazardly by the removals men. Mr. Dibble told us that he too had a little daughter about our own age. It turned out that this little girl was to be our chief playmate for many years. One of the first things we had to get accustomed to, now that we were in Somerset, was the local dialect. At first, Mother found it very difficult to understand. If she asked the way around the village, and was given detailed instructions, she was none the wiser, because she couldn't understand a word. In time, we all adjusted, and gradually began to pick up the intonation ourselves. Most people who know anything about Somerset are familiar with the Mendips and the Quantocks, two long ranges of hills of great beauty, which run for many miles and give the county its unique character. Not so many have heard of the Poldens, a lower, less dramatic, but still very lovely range that runs somewhere between the two, its ridge commanding magnificent views of both, with vast stretches of comparatively flat moors between. At that time they were always called the moors. I never heard them referred to as wetlands or levels until quite recently. So I came to think of all moors as low-lying and flat, full of mystery, with their own flora and fauna, their rinds, peat, bulrushes, and bog grass. Although I must have known that Exmoor was higher, I didn't really connect it with a moor, so I was quite surprised when I came to live in Yorkshire and discovered that the Yorkshire moors, which I had always imagined were like the Somerset ones, were up. The phrase up on the moor rang strange to me for years. In fact, I think there's still a little place somewhere deep down in me that thinks real moors are down. The Poldens were our range. Ashcot was built on the steep side, facing southwest, so that the village was sheltered from the north winds. We rarely had snow, even when it snowed on the Mendips and Quantocks. Perhaps they shielded us from it. It was a self-contained village, and many people rarely left it. At that time, only well-to-do people had a car. So there were few to be seen except those passing along the main Glastonbury Bridgewater Road. Although our house had electric lights in several of the rooms, there were no power points. Few people in the village would have had such things, or any appliances to run from them. It wasn't until after I had left home that the first point was put in the house, and it was a long time after that that the first electric fire, an ancient second-hand one, was obtained. There was mains water, but the tap was just inside the garden wall from the road, so it was a good trek up and down from the house daily to bring it up to the kitchen in a white enamel jug. It all seems very primitive to us today, but it was perfectly normal then, and we felt we were lucky not to have to draw the water from a well. We knew the mains water was clean and fresh, though how often the jug was washed out is anyone's guess. But we all grew up strong and healthy on it, and it was lovely water to drink. We always knew that there was a deep well, located somewhere beneath the stone-flagged courtyard, which had provided the water for previous generations. However, its exact position was not discovered for another 40 years, when my younger brother excavated it, and found it to be a work of exquisite craftsmanship. There was also a well close to the house, which collected the rainwater from the roof. The water was raised by a pump, and used for the garden generally, though as children we used to wash there sometimes, because the water was so soft. There was, of course, no flush toilet, or indeed any drains or pipes of any kind to get blocked or go wrong. A little outside lavatory, containing a seat over a large bucket, was the norm for nearly all the houses in the village. Because it involved going up the garden, whatever the weather, we tended not to use it, except when we had visitors, when it was swept and polished. Chamber pots in the house were simpler, and my father was chief pail emptier. Everything was dug back into the garden, providing humus and nutrients for future crops of vegetables and fruit, so nothing was wasted. I was amused recently when I heard of a cottage in an isolated position which was to be demolished as it was considered unfit for human habitation. The reason given was that it had no running water, electricity, or sewage system. Using that standard of comparison, few of the houses in our village would have been deemed usable. No doubt, not so many years before that, even the palaces and houses of the great would have been similarly unequipped. It does make one realize how easily we become conditioned by our surroundings. Not many years before we went there, our house would have had no electricity, and the well would have been in use. But generations were born and grew up happily there. Just a few times, when the lights failed for some reason, we used a large oil lamp, and it gave a gentle light well suited to those old, low-ceilinged rooms. Often we couldn't afford electric bulbs for upstairs rooms, and the hall and stairs had no lighting. We used small oil lamps and candles frequently. Today these little lights would be looked upon as dangerous. They would have been then in careless hands, but growing up with them we learnt to take care. There was very little furniture in the house at first, just the few things we had brought with us, a new bed and some chairs. Quite soon we obtained a large, round, polished table from a sale. My parents watched out for sales, where they bought things much more cheaply than anything available in shops. It was good furniture, too, and would probably be very valuable by now. The big, round table became very much a feature in our home, and is still owned by the family. A great joy for Mother was the day the piano came. She couldn't live very long without one. When it arrived, she felt that the house was really taking shape. We two children looked at everything and took it all in. We settled ourselves into the new life and explored our domain with satisfaction. Chapter 3, A Somerset Village in the 1930s. At that time, almost everything people needed for their everyday life could be bought in the village. The post office and stores, situated at the side of the village green, could supply groceries, haberdashery, medicines, toys, and sometimes even clothes and shoes. Hobnail boots for boys could also be bought there, and each spring strings of children's sandals were hung up outside, so that mothers could set up their families in footwear for the summer. Although sweets, ice creams and cakes were sold there, fresh cakes, buns and bread could be bought from one of the two bakers who came round the village with a van on different days of the week. We used to get brown loaves from my father, who liked brown best, from one of them, and white loaves, which were a little cheaper for the rest of us, from the other. Both baked all their own bread and cakes at their shop, and the smell of the fresh baking as we went past, something wonderful, yet taken for granted. No one ever dreamed that baker's shops would one day disappear, or at least become places without fragrance, with everything wrapped in plastic bags. Plastic wasn't known in Ascot in 1936. There was a butcher shop too, and the butcher and his assistant came round the village twice a week, delivering orders and selling things, such as sausages and faggots. Today's standards of hygiene did not apply then. Meat was cut up on a wooden slab with grubby hands, occasionally wiped on a rag, as was the sharp knife. No one bothered, and unless memory has gilded the truth, the meat and sausages were delicious. Another trader who came round the village once a week was the fishman. This character, whom we got to know quite well, came round on Friday mornings with a horse-drawn covered cart. Refrigerators were rare then, and it was rumoured that he kept the fish behind the piano in the front room. Be that as it may, we usually bought some fish for Friday dinner, because we were Catholics and meat was not allowed on that day. The fishman also brought a little fruit in season. Mother would buy 5 bananas for 6p. They were small and overripe, but were considered a great treat. When the war came, he went into the Navy, and his visits came to an end. We heard he had landed a congenial job looking after the Admiral's garden. The High Street, apart from its situation towards the higher part of the hill, would have defeated Sherlock Holmes had he been asked to spot it. It was just a lane like any of the others, and we had been in the village some time before we discovered its name. Probably in past years it had been more important, because at one end stood the church. This was very old and beautiful, not one of the spectacular churches for which Somerset is famed, but well worth exploring. In the days when Glastonbury Abbey was thriving, all these villages would have belonged to its area of care. Next to the church was an enclosed space with stone walls built like a little maze. This was the pound, where stray animals were put if they were found roaming around the lanes. They could be driven in, but could not find their way out, until their owner collected them. I was quite sad when, years later, I heard that it had been demolished. Also near the church was a derelict building, which had once been the first school in Ascot, when education gradually became compulsory. In fact, many of the children were kept at home some of the time to help with the work, and none stayed there after they were 12. The older inhabitants of the village had been to school there. We used to go and look at the wooden benches, well carved with the penknives of generations of bored youngsters. About 1920, another school had been built, larger and better equipped, at the other end of the High Street. This one remained in use until the 1980s, when a more modern one, for primary children only, was built on another site. There were 2 little shops in the High Street, both selling groceries and sweets, and sometimes fruit and vegetables in season. You could go to one for some items, and the other for some cheese or butter, and then down to the post office for the rest of your needs, and feel you had been shopping in a big way. One of these little shops also had a bookcase full of books, which you could borrow for a penny per book for a week. This was the nearest thing to a library in the village, though the county library delivered a crate of books regularly to the school, and one of the teachers there made an arrangement for us to borrow them. The forge was also situated in that street. There were still horses around in good numbers, because all the local farmers used them for their work. The first tractors had not come to Ascot as yet. The farms were small but comprehensive, each growing hay and grain, with about a dozen milking cows, some with a few sheep, and most with pigs and poultry. Horses were all important and much loved, and were shod at the forge. I still remember well the smell of the hot shoes being put on the horse's feet, and wondering how these huge shires could be so patient as the blacksmith nailed them on. Halfway along the high street was the Ring of Bells, aptly named for its nearness to the church, which had a good peal. Ashcot was well off for public houses. The Ashcot Inn was on the main road, and there was the Albion at the far end of the village. At the other end stood the Piper's Inn, where Judge Jeffreys of ill repute in Cromwell's time was said to have stayed. This was more of a hotel, despite its name. Besides all these, several of the local farms had their own cider presses and made many gallons of the heady brew for themselves. These presses must have been little changed over the centuries. They were made of two wooden boards with a wooden trough to catch the apple juice, as the fruit, mixed with straw, was crushed gradually by a turn of the screw handle. Apples in the orchards were left to drop from the trees and raked into long piles called graves. We used to think that half of them must be rotten, and certainly as we approached the orchards, we could smell cider. A day would come, however, when the farmer would come along and shovel them all into his cart. Then into the cider press they went. "But what about the slugs, Daddy?" we would ask. Evidently they became part of the brew. There was nothing else added to that cider, no yeast or any agent. It was just the apple juice, which fermented by itself and made a powerful drink. The layers of straw in the press were to facilitate the drainage of the juice into the trough. The compressed apple pulp and straw was called cheese, and was used afterwards as cattle feed. I wonder if anyone makes cider like that today. When we first lived in Ashcot, it was still the custom to toll the church bell when anyone died. This was an ancient Christian custom, alerting the villagers to pray for the souls of the dead person. It also meant that everyone knew there had been a death in the village. Heads would peep out of doorways and windows to see if anyone knew who it was, before deciding who it was most likely to be. Word soon got around of the true identity of the deceased, although no one had a phone except the policeman in the post office. The bell was tolled again on the day of the funeral. The presence of the village policeman was an important factor in the life of the village. His house was almost opposite ours. Every day we would see him setting out on his beat, wearing his cloak and helmet, and riding his bike. He would patrol the village and its surrounding roads. A big, strong man, he was much respected by the locals, at least by the more law-abiding among them. He once told my father that his motto was "Live and let live." I'm not sure how far he applied this in general when he met with breaches of the law. Nowadays, the nearest policeman is 3 miles away in street, or maybe even further away, and the villagers no longer feel so safe. In the 1930s, little children, and bigger ones, could walk for miles or play safely anywhere without their parents having to be anxious about them. It was a world of greater freedom. The roads, called lanes by most people, were swept, and the verges trimmed by a little team of men paid by the local council. They worked their way around the village at a leisurely pace, with a wheelbarrow, spades and brooms, tidying up as they went along. Somehow they managed to appear at the best vantage point when anything was going on in the village, near the church when there was a wedding or funeral, near the pubs when some function was on, etc. They didn't miss much, but it was a poorly paid job, and looked on as being rather a come-down by most people. Even farmhands were a degree further up in the scale in general estimation. Yet when I look back, how hard their lives must have been. The farm labourers worked from morning until night every day, even part of Sunday, because the milking and feeding of the animals had to go on. Yet their wages were only 10 shillings and 6 pence a week. This had to pay the rent of their cottages and keep themselves, their wives, and their children. If they were ill or off work for some reason, then there was no pay for that day. Even if they were not able to work because of bad weather conditions, it was still no work, no pay. There was no question of a holiday or even going anywhere. Many of the children were often ragged and dirty and had lice in their hair. They must have been cold in the winter. Even tiny tots played on the roads. And every year, impetigo and all the other contagious diseases swept through the village. There were no antibiotics. I remember a little boy of 6 dying of measles. The mothers had a tough time. There were none of the labour-saving gadgets that we are so accustomed to today. Many had no mains water. None of us had hot water on tap. One got hot water by boiling it in a kettle. Washing up liquids and detergents were unheard of. However, what we now think of as deprivation was by no means seen as such at the time. No doubt future generations will think of these present days as deprived. There were lots of pleasures, many of which have gone now, to be replaced by television and holidays abroad. Everyone was in the same boat, so to speak, and it was a good boat to be in, and a steady one. When I visited the village 50 years later and saw the young mothers popping the toddlers into their car seats and driving off to town to do the shopping, I realized what a vast change had taken place. The little ones looked so healthy and warmly dressed. I could see that in some ways, at least, it was a change for the better. Chapter 4. A Village Economy. There is so much more I remember about Ashcott on those early days. As most of it will soon have gone from living memory, I thought it worth jotting down a few more things. In the 1930s, there were several other small businesses that served the community and rendered it unnecessary for people to go out of the village. There was Mr. Isgrove, the saddler, who made all the leather equipment for the farm horses. Wearing an apron, he sat stitching the leather in his shop. Not far away from him, Mr. Farrow, the local joiner and carpenter, had his workshop. This was a long open barn where he made many things, including all the coffins, for he was also the undertaker. All the sawing was done by hand in those days, of course. He was a fine craftsman, and in the evenings pursued his hobby of making carved coffee tables. He also played the organ at the church. Further up the hill, Mr. Baker had his barber's shop. He cut men's and boys' hair and sold a few things like woodbine cigarettes and matches. He was a very kind man and good with small children who didn't like having their hair cut. Milk was delivered to the door, as it is today, but in less sterile conditions. Mr. Everdale came round with his horse and trap, a couple of milk churns, a pail and a dipper. He filled the pail for one of the churns, brought it to the door, and measured out the required amount with the dipper into the customer's jug. The churns were tall, heavy metal cans which must have held about 10 gallons apiece. All farmers put their milk straight into these after milking. They were then put outside on a stand beside the farm gate for collection in the early mornings by Wilts United Dairy's milk volley, unless the farmer had his own milk round. Another amenity was the Bridgewater steam laundry. A man came round in a motor van once a week and collected the parcels of washing. It was certainly a great help if you could get sheets washed there. Most of the housewives in the village had a copper and could boil their white laundry when they had the firewood to heat it. Mother only had a bowl on the kitchen table and a domestic-sized kettle on the oil stove. She washed woolies beautifully and most of the other things, but she found sheets in my father's shirts almost impossible to launder, as they were made of cotton or linen. Drip-dry or non-iron fabrics had not yet been invented. So, now and again, these were sent to the laundry. I say now and again because each article cost a penny or more to be washed, and so it all had to be well thought out, and resulted in our using sheets until they were decidedly grey. The laundry van ceased coming round when the war began, so from then on Mother had to manage as well as she could. Charlie Bobbitt could sole and heel shoes in a fairly rough and ready but serviceable way, and Uncle Hancock soldered pots and pans. These two delightful characters shared a little cottage adjoining the reading room, and grew vegetables in the garden there. The reading room was no longer in use for its original purpose by the time we came to live in Ashcot, but it was sometimes used for small functions. It was probably built in Victorian times by one of the local benefactors of the village. Another amenity that was rarely used by then, and was soon to become obsolete, was a water trough for horses. This had a tap and an iron cup chained to it for the use of thirsty humans, and underneath a smaller drinking trough for dogs, cats, and other small creatures. Above, carved in the stone wall, were Coleridge's words, "He prayeth well who loveth well, both man and bird and beast." This refreshment was situated exactly opposite the Ashcot Inn. Maybe the donor hoped that by providing a free drink of water, he was lessening the likelihood of the villagers spending their money in the pub. In time, the tap ceased to function, and the trough dried up. When I revisited the village many years later, the whole thing had gone. We knew it so well. It was where we waited for the bus that ran regularly between Bridgewater and Glastonbury. Although few people had a car, the transport services were good. There were buses regularly throughout the day and early evening. We could also catch a bus to Taunton if we walked down as far as the Piper's Inn. But Taunton was about 17 miles away, and few of the villagers felt the need to venture that far. As well as the main route buses, there was the one belonging to Mr. Dibble. He ran his own bus service between Ashcot and Bridgewater, not along the usual route, but through the lower-lying villages at the edge of the moor, which had no public transport. He went to and fro several times a day, with an extra trip on market day, whatever the weather. He would pick up parcels for people and drop them off at the appropriate place, and generally provided a much-needed service until he retired. There was also Ashcot Station. Admittedly, it was a 2.5-mile walk across the moor, but trains ran regularly between Burnham, Highbridge, and Glastonbury. These lines connected with the Great Western Railway, and on the few occasions that he needed to do so, my father was able to be in London by 11 a.m., providing that he had made an early start by cycling to the station. It was a tiny station, just a single track with its little platform, station master's house, level crossing gates, and signal box. We thought it very exciting, though it was rare indeed that we used it. We went as far as we could walk, and that was the extent of our roaming. Until much later, none of us had bicycles, except my father, and to my mother's relief, he didn't have his for long. The result was that we knew the area in which we lived very well indeed, the nearby towns on the bus route fairly well as we grew older, but never had the opportunity of exploring much beyond this, except through reading. Medically, the village was well served. Two doctors from Street and Glastonbury each ran a surgery in a private house 2 days a week, but doctors had to be paid and were only called on in great need. The main source of help healing and comfort for all and sundry, was that unforgettable woman, the district nurse. She lived right in the centre of the village, beside the village green, or what was left of it. It was called the Batch, and the huge tree that stood in the middle was reputed to mark the central spot of Somerset. In our early days she rode a bicycle, but quite soon, to everyone's delight and approval, she acquired a little car which stood on the Batch when not in use. Nurse was available whenever she was wanted, day or night, rain or shine. Everyone began to feel better the moment she greeted them with her kindly smile. She was called out to all the births and all the dyings, to helpless old men, to little children with measles. Nothing was too much trouble. In theory, she had a day off each week, when she put on ordinary clothes instead of her familiar navy uniform. Everyone did their best to observe this day, which they felt she should have. Yet, if there was a sudden emergency, no one feared to go along and knock on her door. Hers was truly a vocation. She loved all her patients, rejoiced with them in their return to health, and helped them in their anxieties. She saw the younger members of our family into the world, assisting the doctor from street, and found time to enter into the play of the older children on her way in or out of the home. Everyone loved nurse. All this helped to give a sense of stability to the village. Whatever kind of help was needed, it was never far away. Though people didn't have telephones of their own, there was always a neighbour or someone who would run with a message to nurse, the policeman, the grocer, or whoever was needed. There was a public telephone outside the post office, from which one could ring up a doctor or ambulance in real need. Ordinary medicines and ointments, aspirins, wintergreen, syrup of fig, sticking plaster and the like, could be bought at the post office shop. Although this same shop also had what was called the drapery department, where you could buy wool, needles and cottons, patterns, and sometimes even children's and ladies' dresses, there was no shop that actually sold fabrics. To remedy this, a man came round once a month from a shop in Langport with samples of all kinds of material. Customers chose what they wished and ordered the required amount, and he would bring it the next time he called. Mother used to make our little summer frocks, and there would be great excitement when this man arrived in the spring, and we could choose the material for them from his pattern book. The choice was very limited by today's standards, but to us it was an important matter, even more so to Mother, who had to keep a strict eye on the price. The prettiest ones were always too expensive, at 7 or 8 pence a yard. "Look at this lovely one, with the little blue flowers on," she would say encouragingly. "And it's only 6-3 a yard." This meant 6-3 farthings, because farthings were still in use. Some were even 5 pence halfpenny a yard. There were 240 pence in a pound, and a penny was quite a lot of money. In fact, riches to a child. Then there was the oil man. He came round all the villages once a week. From him we bought the paraffin for the oil stove and lamps. But he didn't only have paraffin on board. His was a remarkable vehicle, a kind of lorry with open sides lined with deep shelves. The paraffin was in a tank slung below, and he filled our drum from this. On the shelves and hanging on hooks and piled on top were innumerable things for sale. Cups, plates, kettles, brooms, dusters, doormats, firelighters, matches, soap, all kinds of household wares. He always had some bargain that he felt we really ought to buy. When the war came, he even had toys on board, which people had made and asked him to sell for them. When I revisited Ashcott in 1988, there was still an oil man coming round. Not the same man, but it could well have been the same lorry. By that time he also sold washing-up liquid, paper hankies, toilet paper, fly sprays, and other amenities unheard of in our childhood days, but by now necessities of life. My family thought he only came for mother's sake, and for an old lady unable to walk very far, it made her life a lot easier. She even bought quite a few of her Christmas presents from him, things like torches, pretty cups and saucers, and coloured trays. These regular tradesmen were all very useful, and meant there was little need to go outside the village for shopping. Apart from these fixtures built into the rhythm of the months, there were also itinerant salesmen who knocked on the door hoping to sell their wares. I remember a gentle Indian wearing a turban, but otherwise European clothes, with a large suitcase full of small things such as shoelaces, cottons, needles, press fasteners, hooks and eyes, and tape measures. Even if at the time we were not in need of any of these, and had hardly any cash in the house, my parents always tried to buy something. They were very sensitive to anyone in need, and, as is so often the case, would help however little they had themselves. The same applied when the gypsies came round, selling their clothes pegs and begging for old clothes. On rarer occasions, the knife grinder came. He rode a tricycle and would come to the door to see if we had any scissors, knives, or shears to sharpen. He was very poor and ragged, and stood in the lane beside his tricycle sharpening away, not always very satisfactorily. Once he brought his wife with him, and said she mended doormats. I rather think ours was beyond redemption at the time, so we declined that offer. When Mother heard that his wife was with him, she gave Boo and me a cup of tea to take out to her. It was a cold day, and we found she had a baby in a tattered old pram. She poured the tea into the baby's bottle and fed it. I have always remembered this poignant incident. Chapter 5. A Son, Sir. This was the village which was to be the framework for our lives, the place where those all-important growing and rooting stages were to be accomplished, or at any rate given a good start. We two little girls, with our flaxen pigtails and brown eyes, found a stable world there. We didn't realize it at the time, and took everything for granted. With eagerness and wonder, we explored our immediate surroundings, getting to know the names of the plants and wild flowers in the confines of our own garden and small orchard. To begin with, we didn't go further afield on our own, but we didn't need to do so, for there was endless scope for play and make-believe so close at hand. We played all day long, mostly out of doors or in the old farm buildings, only coming in for meals and sleep. Then some official came round to see why it was that we were not attending school. Boo was just 5 by then, and I was nearly 7. So for a while we went to the village school, and though this did not last long, I was grateful for our time there. The most far-reaching result was that in a comparatively short time we got to know the people in the village. Anyone moving into the village, a rare occurrence then, was a foreigner, and continued to be looked upon one for many years. Even people from towns not far away were foreign, so a family like ours, coming from the London area, and with no previous connection with the village, was viewed with considerable suspicion. Even by the time the war came, there were those who thought my father might be a spy. If we had not had that time among the children of the village, I think we would never have been accepted as we were, and certainly it would have taken our parents a long time to get to know the inhabitants. Children learn so rapidly at that age, and very soon if mother or father asked us, "Who's that lady in the red coat?" we could inform them that it was Pamela's mum, and that she lived at the top of School Hill. And we even had lots more information to give about her family. So this time was one of integration for us all into the social fabric of the village. Whilst on the subject of school, I feel I must pay tribute to the teachers who spent all their lives teaching at that small rural school. For more than 40 years, they were among the most important and respected people in the area. Everyone had been through their hands, either as a pupil or young parent or both. Miss Tilk, who taught the infant class, became a close friend of our family and came to be called Auntie. She had lived in the village all her life, teaching and caring for her mother. As well as the infants class, which was comprised of 4, 5, and 6-year-olds, up to including what was known as Standard 1, she taught the girls from all three classes needlework, knitting, weaving, and other crafts. She also played the piano for the daily hymn at assembly, and was in the playground at break when we all ran wild for a few minutes. A tall lady with silvery strands in her hair, which was worn in a bun. She must have still been quite young when we were there, but we thought of her as middle-aged. Certainly she had wonderful energy and used all her time and gifts to help the children. She had a kindly face and chuckle, and it was quite obvious that she really loved all her charges, though she knew how to correct rascals. Never cross or out of sorts, she always listened to both sides before administering justice. We felt that she knew we were trying, even though the result wasn't very good and left much to be desired. By the time we reached Standard 1, pencils were abandoned in favour of pens and ink, and we wrote in proper exercise books. I still recall the huge blots on my writing book, and how powerless I felt to stop them coming. I suppose I dipped my pen too far into the ink, so it had no option but to make blots. But I didn't understand that at the time. Children today are spared the misery of those pens and inkwells. Miss Telk was also in charge of the county library books, which were delivered regularly to the school. She was a great reader and encouraged both the children and their parents to read. Those library books were a lifeline for our own mother, who had been accustomed to having a library within reach. Books could be ordered in advance. There was a good selection in each consignment. Miss Tilk always referred to them as library books, and this became a household pronunciation with us. Even in the school holidays, Miss Tilk didn't go away. She was so keen to do everything for her charges. She would cut out patterns for their needlework, prepare classes, and study child education books to glean ideas for communicating skills to little ones. There must have been hundreds of people who owed their early training to Miss Tilk. The other two teachers in the school were Mr. and Mrs. King. Mr. King taught the top class, which consisted of the 12- and 13-year-olds. He also taught all the boys woodwork and gardening, while the girls were doing their needlework and handicrafts. It was he who was called on to dispense justice when arbitration had failed. His was the last word, and he alone administered the strap. This leather strap hung on the wall of his classroom and was not often used, only for great or persistent crimes. The boy, I don't think it was ever a girl, had to hold out his hand and receive 2 or 3 smart smacks with the strap. It was not so much the pain, though it must have hurt a bit, but the opinion of the rest of the class that made it a dreaded punishment. Everyone witnessed it and knew that the recipient must have really earned it. Mr. King was a kindly man and rarely made use of the punishment. It was not his way. However, the threat of the strap helped him out of a few difficult situations. Mrs. King taught the middle class. Hers was probably the most difficult task, because some of her children were only just 7. Some were working for their 11-plus exam, and others had to fit in between. She was an excellent teacher, however, and coped well, even putting on quite advanced plays for the Christmas end-of-term celebration. Over the years, I have often looked back and been amazed at the amount Mrs. King and Miss Tilke taught me. All children soak up knowledge rapidly in their early days, but I'm sure their teaching methods must have been very good, for so much to have gone into our heads and stayed there. Miss Tilke taught me all the basics of needlework, including how to do French seams, run and fell, and various embroidery stitches. It was Mrs. King who first introduced me to the wonderful stories in the Bible, such as David and Goliath, Elijah being fed by the ravens, and Elijah's servant seeing the little cloud as big as a man's hand. This gave me the interest to read them for myself and explore the Bible further, a passion that has never really left me. We made friends with the children, though they regarded us cautiously, and wanted to know why we didn't talk proper. They taught us a lot. Probably children teach other children as much as the teachers do. Quite soon, however, my parents obtained permission to teach us at home, for which they were well qualified. And so began the Litchfield School, as we like to call it. It was wonderful. We had occasional lessons, perhaps a whole morning of algebra, but did lots of reading on our own and had plenty of play. About this time, a man came to the door, taking orders for a new encyclopedia designed for older children. It was called The Book of Knowledge, 8 large, well-printed tomes, edited by Harold F.B. Wheeler. It was beautifully bound, and was, of course, very expensive. To Mother's initial horror, my father ordered a set. It must indeed have seemed a crazy thing to do, since we could often afford only the bare necessities of life. But it proved to be a stroke.